It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, the Senate CIA torture report looked at enhanced interrogation methods in the war on terror and tried to figure out if they were legal and effective. We preview a new Frontline documentary on the topic called Secrets, Politics, and Torture.
First, we're taking a closer look at a controversial taxpayer-funded loan from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation to a struggling Milwaukee construction company. The loan is raising lots of questions about WEDC or WEDC, and some Democratic lawmakers are calling for a federal investigation.
Matthew DeFore has been covering this story, and he's here to break it down for us. He's the state government reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Veronica, thanks so much for having me back.
So to start at the beginning, the WEDC made a $500,000 loan to a company called Building Committee Incorporated. That loan was not repaid, and that loan is what is at issue now. What makes it controversial?
Well, as the Democrats pointed out yesterday in calling for a federal investigation, there were some troubling things that we reported in our story on Sunday, the first of which is that this company, when they applied for their loan to the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, indicated that they had not been the subject of a lawsuit in the previous 5 years. Simple CCAP search showed that they had three lawsuits filed against them in 2010, a year before they applied for this loan. The application also indicated that they were partnering with Michael's Energy, a La Crosse-based company, and UW-Milwaukee. When we talked to officials with the company and the school, they said that they had not been in touch with this group since 2009. They had done minimal work. They weren't really technically partners with them and had not heard that they'd even applied for this loan or even received it. So on one side of this, you have a company that appears to have been saying things that were not accurate on their application. But then in the underwriting process that should have happened at WEDC, that thing could have been very easily reviewed. So the second thing that's troubling is what happened in the underwriting process. And there are some details we know, but we're also still looking into others. But the third thing, and I think this is where Representative Peter Barker yesterday was using the term possible corruption, is our story very clearly laid out how Governor Walker's top aides, his Secretary of Administration, and others in his administration were pushing for this loan. And we talked to WEDC CEO Paul Jaden, who described very clearly how it wasn't just a matter of them, suggesting this to them at the start of the process. Secretary Hipsch, according to Paul Jaden, was involved at the beginning, and then after they got the $500,000 loan, he came back asking for more money for this company. They were looking for $4.3 million. And then he continued until at one point Secretary Jaden had to bring him and this Bill Minahan gentleman in for a meeting and sat them both down and had Mr. Minahan explain the project, at which point it was apparently clear to Secretary Hipsch that this was not a good idea to give him anything more than the $500,000 original loan.
Was it, as you understand it, unusual for an official in the government like Secretary Hipsch to sort of broker a loan with WEDC for the company?
As Paul Jaden told us, he cannot recall another time when the secretary became an advocate like he did in this situation. This was very unusual.
And at the time of the loan, was there evidence that the BCI was failing, as it later became evident?
Well, like I mentioned, there was the red flags at the front end are these lawsuits, which, again, a simple underwriting check of the court records would have shown that they had misrepresented themselves on their application. The application itself even says that any misrepresentation is automatic grounds for denial of a loan. However, we found additional evidence that this company was in a state of collapse. In mid-2011, we talked with the manager of a credit union in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And they had had this company build them a credit union, which was their typical line of business. They weren't actually involved in the kind of energy efficiency projects that they were trying to get through the stimulus. But they did do this credit union in Oklahoma, and they apparently when it came time for them to pay their subcontractors for the work, subcontractors weren't being paid. And so the subcontractors went to the credit union to be paid, and they said, "We'll put a lien on your building unless you pay us." So the credit union manager paid them, and then contacted Minahan saying, "Hey, you know, we want the money for this." And so Minahan told him, "Well, don't worry about it. We're getting this $4.3 million grant from the state of Wisconsin. Our money got mingled in with that. You'll get your payment." They never got paid and ended up going to the FBI with their concerns. So, yes, we know that this company was in some serious financial trouble throughout this period.
And another strand of this is that it sounds as though prior to this loan being made by WEDEC to BCI, BCI had become a donor to Friends of Scott Walker. What do we know about what they contributed and when?
Well, what we've been able to determine is that Mr. Minahan was giving money to both Democrats and to Governor Walker and Republicans. So it appeared that, all I can say is that we know he was giving money to Democrats in 2009, including Tammy Baldwin, Ron Kind, Governor Doyle, Harry Reid, when the stimulus money was available for these energy efficiency projects. So there appeared to be some interest. He had hired a lobbyist to try to secure some kind of federal funding. That never panned out. Governor Doyle and the Democratic representatives told us that they never gave him any money. He then gave a $10,000 donation to Governor Walker on Election Day in 2010, and it was within the next 6 months he was meeting with Governor Walker's Chief of Staff, Keith Jilks, and Secretary Hipsch to explain his energy efficiency program, and then they forwarded that to the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation for some kind of loan.
We're talking right now with Matthew DeFore. He is covering the story out of Wisconsin, that the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation had made a loan to the Building Committee Incorporated that was not repaid. It's at issue right now as being controversial, and we're getting to the bottom of that a little bit here. And Democratic lawmakers are asking for a federal investigation right now, Matthew. Will federal prosecutors, do you think, go through with an investigation? What would happen there?
They're not commenting right now on what they're going to do. I think our story illustrated some definite issues with Mr. Minahan's business practices. I mean, I can't say what they're going to do for sure. The Democrats are also calling, they're describing the activity here with the Walker administration pushing for this as being a sign of corruption. I mean, I think, though there's certainly a lot of questions, I don't know what they're going to do in terms of investigations, but we have a lot of questions about what exactly was going on here. The term that the Democrats are using is pay for play. What's not clear to me is, were they just exuberant about fulfilling this 250,000 jobs pledge? So they were just, they kind of looked beyond some of the shortcomings of this company because they were just so enamored with getting more jobs and doing it however they could. Or was there something else here? Did they see a wealthy donor and think, here's somebody who, we want to help out. Maybe he'll contribute to us in the future. For example, during this time period, we've seen evidence in the courts that there was an effort that Governor Walker was involved in to raise money for Wisconsin Club for Growth. We don't know if Mr. Minahan gave any money to that group, but those are the kinds of questions we would like to see answered so that we can be satisfied to know whether this was, again, exuberant job creation or something more.
Now, what has Governor Walker said about whether or not he knew about this loan and maybe whether or not he was advocating for it?
Governor Walker has said he has no knowledge of this loan deal. There's a little bit of confusion about in a memo that went to or in a letter that Paul Jaden signed, awarding this grant, or I'm sorry, this loan. It's CC'd to Governor Walker, although that was, according to Governor Walker's office and WEDEC, that was never forwarded to the governor. They have no record of it being sent to them, and I'm pretty confident that that's the case, that the governor's office did not get a copy of that. So he's basically saying he was not aware of that element and the details. But again, his chief of staff and his head of administration were very familiar with this loan and with this person. Whether they knew all his background and they knew that he owed money to other people, we don't I mean, it's very likely, I would say, that they didn't know that those things, because, you know, I don't think anyone really knew those things. But, you know, we just, it's, I think when the people at the highest levels of the Walker administration were familiar with this, I think people can question whether the governor knew absolutely nothing. But it's, I guess, entirely possible.
And just briefly, before we let you go, on Friday, the governor called for an end to WEDEC's loan program. Is this a sign, do you think, that his office is taking this seriously?
Well, according to him, getting rid of the loan program is related to the audit that came out a week before showing that there were all kinds of problems in tracking loans. Now, that audit mentioned that 9 loans had been written off in the previous year. One of those loans that was written off was the Building Committee Inc. loan. They're still trying to pursue that lost money through a lawsuit, but there's no indication at this point that the state's going to ever recover that $500,000.
Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Matthew DeForest, a government reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us to talk about the controversial WEDEC loan to the company BCI.
Two big questions have surrounded the CIA since reports began surfacing of the possible use of torture or enhanced interrogation techniques to interrogate terror suspects. Are these techniques legal, and did they actually work?
The award-winning film Zero Dark Thirty about the search for Osama bin Laden suggested that torture did actually help lead the CIA to the perpetrator of the 9/11 attacks. However, since the Senate Intelligence Committee released its so-called CIA torture report at the end of last year, a lot more information has been available to the public about what the CIA did and what it achieved.
In a new documentary, Frontline uses that report, along with interviews with politicians and CIA insiders, to paint a picture of what the CIA's interrogation program was actually like and whether it was effective. The documentary Secrets, Politics, and Torture airs tonight at 9 on your local public TV station. The producer of that documentary, Jim Gilmore, joins us now. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad you guys invited me.
So I want to start with a kind of opposition I stated there earlier, torture or enhanced interrogation. Knowing what we know now, is it journalistically sound to call what the CIA did torture?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear for quite a while that what it was torture. I mean, even the president at this point and the head of the CIA admit that some of the techniques used were torture. That much is clear, but the debate goes on after this December report came out from the Senate about many other aspects of it, like did it work or not. The CIA continues to argue that they did, and the evidence that comes up in this intelligence report states that, in fact, it was a dismal failure.
Now, this Senate report, you refer to it a lot in this documentary. We've talked about it some here on the show. How much of what they did, though, is actually available to us? How much is still locked away and classified?
I mean, well, the report itself is over 6,000 pages long. They came out with a summary edition of it that was also edited out after a huge debate with the administration, the CIA, on what could or could not come out. And that was about a little over 600 pages. So there's a lot more that's out there that is not public. And another interesting part of it is that during the research of the 6 million documents that the Senate researchers were involved in, they also came across another document called the Panetta Review, which was an independent review by the CIA done at the same time as the documents were being handed over to the Senate. And it had conclusions and sort of a overview of what they were handing over, what the document stated, which the Senate says matched their conclusions almost exactly, and in fact did not agree with the CIA's official point of view about the program itself. And that is completely still classified, and the new head, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, wants to send that back to the CIA. So that's another outstanding document. But a lot did come out in the research, in this research document that the Senate put out.
Now, you tell a story in some ways of the CIA and the Justice Department and the administration making this up as they went along. Before 9/11, before we had these black sites and these approved enhanced interrogation techniques, what was in the toolkit for the CIA or FBI, for that matter?
Well, I mean, not a lot. Certainly in the past, during Vietnam and stuff, there were programs. But at this point, there were no detention sites. There were no experts in interrogation. The folks that were doing interrogation of Al Qaeda was the FBI. The FBI had all that expertise. And what happened in the very beginnings, as they started to capture Al Qaeda officials and soldiers, is they had to figure out what to do with them, and they did not want to go forward with the FBI in control of this. The CIA wanted control of it. And they also thought that they had to be much more harsher in their procedures. And so what they did is they came up with, out of whole cloth, a new system. First of all, they opened up, of course, all the black sites around the world. And then they hired on these two former Air Force psychologists, a guy by the name of James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who developed, by reverse engineering, a program of tactics used by the Chinese in the Korean War, techniques to try to find information from folks that didn't want to give the information over. The FBI pulled out from all of these interrogations because they didn't trust them. They thought they were illegal. We talked to in the film one of the chief FBI interrogators, who said that the psychologists had never interrogated anybody. They had no expertise in Islamic fundamentalism, and they couldn't believe this direction. And the film sort of tells the chronology of how, over time, even though interrogators were saying they were not finding the information they thought, that the techniques perhaps were not always achieving what they expected to achieve, the need for intelligence by Washington, the feeling that they did have the right people, pushed headquarters to tell the interrogators to push harder, and prevented them, I think, from sort of giving a better understanding, an overview of what was being accomplished by the system, and questioning the directions that they were taking.
Talking to Jim Gilmore, producer of tonight's Frontline documentary, Secrets, Politics, and Torture, on CIA enhanced interrogation techniques of terror suspects. Let's look at the legal side of this now. We have a clip from the documentary. This is John Rizzo, at the time the CIA's legal counsel on this issue, talking about getting approval for these techniques.
I fully realize that either way, someday, somehow, we would be screwed.
And the morality of it?
Honestly, my main focus was to attempt to ascertain, to clarify with certainty, whether or not any or all of these techniques crossed that legal line into torture. That was my primary focus at that point. The morality of it, sure, I had views about that, but I did not view that as my primary role.
These techniques, waterboarding, most famously sleep deprivation, slapping in the face, grabbing the face, others, who ultimately signed off and said, yes, these are legal for the CIA to use?
Well, the CIA went through this whole process of going to the Justice Department to see if it was legal or not. And then to the White House for final approval. I mean, Rizzo told us basically that he felt it was above his pay grade to decide on the morality of this. That was the decision to be made by the White House. But I had people tell me at the White House that that they believed that if the Justice Department said it was legal and the CIA said it was effective, because of the trauma of the times, because of the need to stop the next attack, they basically were willing to sign off on it very quickly. And the president, who didn't know the details of the techniques or of the program, did know that and did ask whether it was effective and legal. And when he was told it was, he signed off on it quickly. So it this question of morality seemed to have never come up. It was always, what can we do, not what should we do? And that, of course, is one of the major questions of why why that was the case.
And the, as you mentioned up front, the CIA said this was effective. Actionable intelligence came from enhanced interrogation. Senate report says no. What can you lay out as we wrap up the argument? Did it work?
Well, I mean, I think the important thing about that is when the CIA sold this program, they sold it as the only way to get information that would save thousands of lives, that would stop the next attack. But even now, the CIA's response to the Senate report in their report that they put out, they now say that, well, there are other ways that we probably could have gone to get this information, that rapport building is something that maybe should have been looked at more clearly. So the reality is that there were other ways to try to get this information. Whether they got the information at all, because the Senate report is very clear and very strong on the fact that the information that they were looking for, they rarely did get, that the information came from other sources. And so that's the quandary, and that's the bottom line is was it effective at all? It's very questionable. And number two, were there other ways to gather that information? And the truth of that is yes, probably.
Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, guys.
That's Jim Gilmore, producer and reporter with Frontline. You can hear a lot more in his documentary, Secrets, Politics and Torture. It airs tonight at 9 on your local public television station.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It seems like just about every day or thereabouts, there's a new story or study about our declining attention spans, something we've talked about here on Central Time. A lot of times people blame technology. They say social media is rewiring our brains or our smartphones are making us oblivious to the rest of the world around us.
Our next guest says technology isn't the cause of the problem, but it's a symptom. He argues we're having the wrong debate about distraction, that the problem is that we're too autonomous with no direction for our attention. Matthew B. Crawford is here to explain what he means. He's a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture and the author of The World Beyond Your Head on Becoming an Individual in an Age of Distraction. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what do you mean when you say that attention is a cultural problem?
Well, attention is this mental faculty by which we pick something out from all the stuff that's coming at us and say, that's important. And I think we've become kind of agnostic on the question of what's worth paying attention to, that is, what to value. And I think this is connected to our economic life, where we're bombarded with so many choices and options. And the economists tell us that freedom consists of satisfying your preferences. And to discover your true preferences requires maximizing the number of choices you face. But this is precisely the condition that makes for maximum distraction and dissipation of your energies.
Are we also at a point where we need to think of our attention as a resource, the way we might think of clean water and clean air, something that's limited?
Exactly. I mean, attention is something we have only so much of, but we're not yet very articulate in making a claim for our attention on our own behalf. And just like clean air makes it possible to breathe, I think silence is a resource of just that sort, and it makes it possible to think, which is no small thing.
And you talk about silence as being something that's part of a sort of a common property, the commons, and also something for the common good. How do you make that case?
Well, when you're passing through an airport, it seems like every surface has been claimed for commerce, and you can shift in your seat and avert your gaze from the screens, but the fields of view that haven't been claimed by some technology trying to appropriate your attention are getting fewer and narrower. And of course, you can put on noise-canceling headphones if you're willing to spend $400 or whatever, but I think we need to sort of reclaim public spaces as being for the public. And I think there's a widespread sense that that the very idea of a public has been eroded, and that's connected to our sense that politics has been captured by by narrow interests, so that any kind of public space feels like it's been turned into a mere surface for the display of enticements, you know, to be somewhere else.
And you're right that I think it's in the luxury lounge of the Charles de Gaulle Airport that the luxury lounge is actually quiet. It's the only place where there isn't a lot going on by way of advertisements and media trying to get your attention. I guess that sort of suggests that the new commodity is silence and sort of simplicity and freedom to think in a way.
Yeah, it's offered as a luxury good. So at that business class lounge in Paris, all you hear is the occasional tinkling of a spoon against china. It's really lovely. And you, when you walk in there, your neck muscles relax, your brow unfurrows itself. The difference is almost tactile. It's like stepping out of hair cloth into satin. And when you consider that it's those in the business lounge who are making the decisions that determine the character of the peon lounge, and you might start to see these things in a political light. Because to, you know, engage in the sort of playful, inventive thinking that you can when it's silent, you know, maybe one thing you're coming up with is sort of brilliant marketing schemes to inflict on those on the peon lounge. So I think it's good to think of this as a transfer of wealth that's occurred when some people treat the minds of other people as a sort of resource that can be harvested by mechanized means.
Would you say that this is something that we, and by we I mean society, everybody is entering into willingly? We want to be connected. We want to know what's going on in various networks. We want to be part of the hubbub and the information that's available. If not, we might be left out from whatever it is, economic or social opportunity. So isn't this something we're kind of choosing to enter into?
Well, yeah, there's, of course, a big distinction between intrusive advertising and the things that we willingly invite into our lives. But some of those can sometimes be disturbing as well, because sometimes it's hyper-palatable, if you want to call it that, mental stimuli like porn or Candy Crush, things that are sort of seem to tap into hardwired preferences our brains have. And these can be disturbing because they seem to crowd out other forms of engagement with our surroundings and with other people. So I think it's possible to make an analogy with fast food. Just as food engineers figured out how to create things like Cheetos that are hard to resist by getting the levels of salt and fat and sugar just right, I think the media have become quite expert at creating stimuli that our brains are kind of hardwired to love. And so one sort of question that comes up is, if human experience is sort of much more saturated with these manufactured experiences that have been designed around us precisely in order to capture and hold our attention, I think it means that human experience has become a more engineered and therefore more manipulable thing.
We're talking right now with Matthew Crawford. He's the author of The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. Let's focus on the becoming an individual part of this, because a part of what you say is that in a way it's too much autonomy that's creating the problem here. So how does that tie in with the prospect of becoming an individual?
Well, in the book, I present these case studies of people engaged in skilled practices. So I talk about hockey players, motorcycle racers, short order cooks, people who make glass, and people who make musical instruments. And one of the things that's really impressive in all of these skilled practices is that the people's mental energy seem to get gathered to a point. And they no longer are in this condition of having to exclude things by sort of mental discipline. It's almost like falling in love once you start to become competent in something. So, and one thing that stands out in all of these examples is that it's hard to understand them under the kind of rubric of freedom or autonomy. They're actually submitting to some discipline that has its own kind of imperatives to it. And, you know, to become a competent musician, you have to practice scales endlessly and sort of accommodate yourself to the mechanical realities of your instrument, whatever it may be. And in all of these examples, there's a feeling of joining the world beyond your head by becoming competent in something real. And that's very different than being a passive consumer of experiences that are kind of designed around you. But to get to throw yourself into something like that, you do have to initially be able to kind of free yourself from these more things that are immediately engaging. So there's a bit of asceticism required to get into it.
Right. You make it sound like a spiritual discipline. You sort of yoke yourself to something else, and that gives you the freedom to direct your attention. So are you saying we have to give up freedom in order to get it?
I think we need to be more self-conscious about how the language of freedom has been turned to manipulative purposes. It's become the language of marketing, you know. So the credit card offer says no limits or you're in charge. So it's a kind of sly appropriation of our most cherished ideal. You know, one can trace this to a certain picture of the modern self and what the dignity of the self requires. Back in Enlightenment thought, it requires a certain independence from the surrounding world. And, you know, the language of marketing seems to offer that kind of freedom as something we're entitled to, whereas I think actual, I don't know if freedom's the right word, maybe agency tends to arise when we're engaged in something that makes demands on us. And it's not simply a matter of becoming independent of the world. It's more like throwing yourself into the world.
We're talking right now with Matthew Crawford. He's got a new book out called The World Beyond Your Head. We're talking about what he sees as our current crisis of attention.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Do you feel like your attention, your focus is a scarce resource? Do you feel like there's so many distractions, so many things to keep track of that you never actually do the thing that you want to do, the thing that you love? Do you think our attention spans are getting shorter? If so, why? And do you think we're too disconnected from the world around us, maybe from each other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion with author Matthew Crawford about his new book called The World Beyond Your Head.
And you can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. In a busy world with lots of distractions, have you found a way to tune it out, to concentrate on the thing you want to do? A craft, maybe. A long book. You know, a relationship. What do you do to ignore life's daily distractions? Do you have tips for exploring what our guest calls the world beyond your head? Do you agree with our guest that we could use some help figuring out what to pay attention to and how to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Matthew, you talked about some professions and sort of these prolonged apprenticeships that some people have with a discipline, say like a jazz musician or a glass blower or a hockey player. Can we talk about one of those and how that sort of prolonged apprenticeship can actually help us learn what to focus on, what to pay attention to?
Yeah, well, I guess I can refer to my own experience. I started working on cars when I was young and worked at a Porsche shop, and then a few years later had a real mentor who taught me to rebuild VW engines. And one thing that stands out is just how involved he was in this. You could see the disgust on his face when, you know, someone had not done something right on an engine, or some subtle pleasure sort of flit across his face when he'd see something well done. And I think that's pretty typical, that when you go deep into some particular skill or art, you become really discerning about, you know, in this case, engines, whatever it might be. And I think it trains your powers of concentration and perception. And that's relevant for our economy, because, you know, apprenticeship is something that's often criticized for being too narrow in education. It's said that everyone should be flexible, as though they shouldn't be burdened with any particular set of skills or knowledge. But it can have this effect of getting initiated into an ethic of caring about what you're doing when you go deep into something. And that's what makes someone really care about quality at a kind of visceral level.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Amelia joining us from Milwaukee. Amelia, hi.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm a student and I go to school in D.C., university, and I'm just calling to talk about specifically, like you said, with education, there are changes from the idea of a liberal arts curriculum where you focus on a lot of different things, but having grown up with the internet and with the college application process is very competitive and very achievement-oriented, it seems that students my age, we really don't get to delve into one thing specifically. It's very rare. I know at my school, everyone's trying to have an internship as well as take a full course load and participate in four extracurriculars or something like that. And I think that leaves a lot of room for delving in the apprenticeship way or perhaps in a more traditional form of education.
Okay, thank you for your call, Amelia. And Matthew, what do you think about the different schools of education thought, you know, having a broad sort of liberal arts base or taking the time to go deeply into one or two things?
Well, I mean, ideally, you would do both. Of course, time is short and we don't always have the luxury of doing everything. So, I mean, one of the rationales really the most prominent one for going to college is that so that you can make a good living. But for the last, 5 years, there's an awful lot of unemployed college graduates. Meanwhile, people who become competent diesel mechanics or welders are in huge demand. So, there are very good reasons to study the liberal arts that I think have nothing to do with earning a living. And as long as you're clear-sighted about that, go to it. I think it's also true that one can read challenging books in a context that's not the university. Personally, I didn't get seriously interested in books until after college. And, I meet a lot of people for whom that's the case, and it almost seems strange that those years of 18 to 22 would be the ones when you're supposed to have your head buried in a book, because that's when, the hormones are raging and you're trying to figure out all kinds of other dimensions of life that have nothing to do with scholarship.
Amelia, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate that. We're going to go next to Steve. Steve's joining us from Lake Geneva. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in my early 50s. And I've been around the world, and I first noticed this in the late 1980s, early 90s, in places like Shanghai, Hong Kong, and then bigger cities in the U.S., and then eventually just kind of took over our society as I kind of dropped out from television and I had children, and I really give them a lot of space and time and silence so that they can think. What I see is it's about power and control, at least that's what I feel. Without being paranoid about it, it's very much, if you don't have the time to think for yourself, be in touch, whether it be with God or your own personal spiritual beliefs, or just make a good decision about what you're going to do with your life or your time or your day or even what show or book you're going to read, then that's about power and control. And when somebody has that and they don't give you that space to, for whatever reason, think for yourself or have that peace and quiet. I lived in a gang-ridden neighborhood for a while in Chicago, and constantly the boomboxes and the stereos were going in the cars, and I just said, you know, it really blocks out cognitive thinking. It's all about just reaction then. And I found it very threatening, and I find it threatening in our society that it exists. It's so prevalent that we're just clawed at in so many ways. We just
Steve,
need time
thank you so
ourselves.
Much for that. Sorry to cut you off there. I just want to make sure we get a chance for our guest to respond. Matthew, what is the worth, as Steve was talking about there, of having that space to think clearly, to make decisions? What is that worth to an individual and to society?
I think, I think it's true. We are clawed at. I like that expression that the caller used. And, you know, I think we're engaged in this constant low-level effort of excluding all these stimuli that are coming at us, and it's exhausting. It's a sort of a cumulative effect of feeling mentally fragmented and exhausted. And I also like what the caller sort of mentioned, the idea of control. This is kind of hard to get at, but when we're all tuned into mass entertainments because they're so compelling, and let's face it, television has become awesome, it means it's very hard to devote yourself to something that isn't immediately engaging, like reading that difficult book or practicing a musical instrument, because the payoff isn't going to come until later. So I wonder if we're becoming more similar to one another, a kind of homogenization of human beings due to these stimuli that are designed precisely in order to capture and hold our attention.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us and talking about your book today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Matthew B. Crawford. He's a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture, and he's also the author of the new book, The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction.
I may try to put some of that into practice. I try to learn musical instruments or get better at them, and I'm really easily distracted. So I'm going to try to put this into practice and develop that focus. You?
I think everybody's guilty of that now,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah.
I always want to put my smartphone down more and do, like you said, an instrument is a great example. Something for everybody to work on, I guess. Bird watching or birding is often a quiet, contemplative thing to do, but starting at midnight tonight, it's going to be a head-to-head competition in Wisconsin as two teams race to spot the most bird species in a 24-hour period.
It's bird watching mayhem Wednesday. Well, maybe it won't be quite that over the top. This is a birding big day. It pits Team Curlew and Screech against Team Cleopatra and the Stilts, and they're hoping to set a record for most birds spotted in Wisconsin in a single day. It's all part of a bigger effort by the DNR and conservation groups called the Great Wisconsin Birdathon. They're hoping to get Wisconsinites to have a big day of their own, and we've got a link to more info now at the Central Time Facebook page.
And speaking of birds, yesterday we talked about peregrine falcons in Wisconsin, and along the way we played the call of the peregrine falcon, and then we heard from Frank on Facebook, and he wrote, "Great show, however, my cats are freaking out after hearing the falcon call. They're going to be under the beds for a while today."
Yeah, so we're going to have some kind of content warning from now on, I think, if we play bird calls. Or maybe it's just raptors. I don't know.
Owls,
but,
birds of prey.
We'll try to make a commitment to this, Frank, to warn you and your cats before we play any birds. I don't do a lot of birding. You've done some, Veronica.
I have done some by force and by choice because my mother is a rabid, or maybe
force.
I should say avid. She's an avid bird watcher, and so I've learned to love the little guys.
All right. Well, a warning to cat owners now. We're going to go to the news with one of our favorite bird sounds behind the scenes here at Central Time. This is a Sand Hill Crane on the Ideas Network.